adjusting the length of the radiator and putting the right extra capacitor or inductor on the antenna, just one other component plus the right length, you can make the impedance of your whip antenna or the impedance of your dipole be anything between 1 ohm and 1500 ohms, and I'm not kidding. If you want your dipole to have an impedance of 321.5 ohms, you choose the right length, and you put the right extra capacitor on it, and you will get that in one step. You don't have to use fancy mechanical impedance matching structures. The dipole or the monopole will do that for you automatically if you know what you're doing, just adjusting the length and adding one extra component. That's an extremely well-kept secret. It's been published in plain sight for 60-some-odd years, since 1945, when Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward published those set of curves of real measured resistive component and real measured reactive component. Let me drop it. Of a monopole-like antenna of various lengths and various diameters. It took them a man year, I think, of work to gather all of that data. And it's not some approximation. It's not somebody's derived equation where they made a whole bunch of approximations and a whole bunch of guesses. It's real measured data. You could say straight from the horse's mouth, if you know what I mean. So that chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook with the Brown and Woodward curves, arguably it is the most valuable piece of information that's in every one of those Antenna Engineering Handbooks, all 4 editions. You'll be amazed how many people who have worked for 20 years in the antenna design department of a company and never discovered Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Because it's not part of the courses that you're given. It's just something that you never run into. You don't realize how valuable it is. It's hidden in plain sight all of these years. So Motorola did that, if you know what I mean. Whether they did it by looking at those curves or some other cut-and-try technique and they came up with their design, whatever they did, it's an extremely good mechanical design that's got great survivability and good electrical performance. What else? What else is there to complain about? You may not like the fact that it's a little bit pricey, but it's a darn good product. I bet you've used a few of those over the years, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have, and it's amazing sometimes how you can look at things with a simple installation and it'll do you just as well as some of the complex stuff. But if we have time, Dick, I have a question also on something I've been working on, but it seems like it's a slow night, but if there's nobody else out there, I'd like to bring about a question I have. But go ahead with your description.
Very fine, John. I'm approximately finished. The modern-day elaborate technique for measuring the exact impedance of anything, whether it's the input of an amplifier, the input of an antenna, your coaxial cable, whatever, is a vector network analyzer. What is a vector network analyzer? It's a synthesized signal generator where you can set it on the exact frequency. It's a synthesized signal generator that will sweep in frequencies. You tell it what frequency to start at and what frequency to stop, and it'll repetitively sweep through those frequencies and display the results on the cathode read tube screen. And inside of there is a pair of directional couplers. It measures the forward going power coming out of that signal generator going into your device on the test. It measures the reflected power from your device on the test by the second directional coupler. And by way of those directional couplers, those detectors, and a real good calculating program inside, it'll display your data as a XY plot of standing wave ratio, frequency horizontal, standing wave ratio vertical, XY plot of frequency horizontal versus reflection coefficient in decibels vertical, dBm so to speak, or as a Smith chart. You tell it which display you want, it does all the right calculating and displays that all for you. What Mr. Brown and Woodward did back in the dark ages of 1945 is they took a real signal generator. In those days, they weren't frequency synthesized. They were driftometers, if you know what I mean. Let me drop.
Like that, driftometers.
You believe it. You'd have to warm up your signal generator for a minimum of a half hour to an hour for it to at least slow down in its drift rate so that you could make it sit on one frequency long enough you could make a measurement. And then you used a frequency meter. It was not a frequency counter. It's a frequency meter, this great big barrel-like device. Or maybe it's even electrical wires. So by some means, you measure the frequency that's coming out of your signal generator. That, in turn, went through a slotted line into the antenna on the test, the quarter-wave monopole antenna-like structure in the middle of this great big sheet of metal, and to putting in monopoles of various diameters, various lengths, and sweeping it in frequency one step at a time. In other words, you reset the dial on the signal generator, you use the frequency meter to measure the re-frequency, you install the new whip, the new length, the new diameter of the whip, and then by way of the slotted line, you find out where the peak and the valley is, and what's the ratio between the peak and the valley, and you go to your slide rule, and you do 10 minutes worth of calculations, and that gives you the standing wave ratio and the phase angle of one dot on that graph. You've got to put the hundreds of dots on that graph just to get one of those curves, and there's about 30 curves on that graph. As I said, it's a man year's worth of work, all of that data that's in those beautiful charts. And you don't have to worry about, is it an approximation? It's the real thing. And so very, very valuable information hidden in plain sight all of these years. No course that we take in electrical engineering school teaches that very valuable piece of information. Let me drop. And last December of 2013, I'm at the Hazeltine Company on Long Island in Huntington, and the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE is giving a presentation on impedance matching devices to be used on antenna. Al Lopez is the man who used to work with Wheeler Laboratories, a very learned guy, was giving the lecture. And when I started asking questions from the audience, and I mentioned the Brown and Woodward curves, the other antenna engineers in the audience said, what chapter is that in? In other words, they had never come across it in any of their courses or any of the work on antenna design that they had been doing all of those years. It amazed the hell out of me. Well, I was one of those victims also. I went through 35 years of doing antenna work for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and then I'm going into a consulting business for the next 10 years, and I was a couple of years into that consulting business before I suddenly discovered those Brown and Woodward curves. I had a very difficult impedance matching problem where we couldn't have very much space to put in impedance matching devices on an antenna that was tucked into the corner of this handheld device that we were designing. Let me drop. And I needed some very crafty way of achieving good impedance match on a dipole-like antenna where I didn't have the room for a great big impedance matching structure to be put in there. And just by finding the right length and the right single capacitor to match that reactance, it all fell out in one step. And I said, wow, why hasn't somebody told me this before? Go ahead with your question, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, very good. I'll try. Now, last week I was going to attempt it, but I didn't have my question set up right. I wasn't prepared, but I think I have a little more information to give you this week. What I'm basically doing, let me let it drop. I have two Yagi antennas. One's a 4-element, one a 15-element. The 4-element is transmitting. The 15-element is receiving. They're 500 megahertz. What I'm doing is I am bouncing signal off a target, which is about, I'd say, 150 yards from the antenna. Now, I have the antenna set horizontal polarity. Small antenna, the transmitting antenna, is in back of the receiving antenna, about 4 foot higher. They're approximately 18 feet off of the ground. So I send a pulse out, and I'm looking for it to come back. I'm monitoring both with a spectrum analyzer, frequency domain, and the oscilloscope. Drop again. Okay, I take my basically 0 dBm signal, feed it into the transmitting antenna, send out a pulse. At the same time, it's loosely coupling to the receiving antenna to give me a trigger base for my oscilloscope. So when I fire the pulse, the scope triggers, and then I'm able to measure the return pulse coming back on the 15-element Yagi. The problem is, I'm shooting down my driveway in a southern direction, and I even had to take the van out of the driveway because the echoes were just driving me crazy between off the buildings and whatnot. What I found, when I shifted it to vertical polarization, it reduced those echoes that I didn't want by about 20 dB. Is there any other suggestion you could make as far as polarity or what else I could try to minimize those echoes which are coming from other obstructions?
Yeah, history is repeating itself, John. You're doing an experiment that I did, a somewhat similar experiment, in the world's largest indoor antenna range at Edwards Air Force Base, then called the Air Force Anechoic Facility, the AFAF, and then later became the Benningfield Anechoic Facility, an acre and a half of chamber, 300 foot square, 7 stories high. And I was doing something very similar to what you're describing. I was trying to measure where are the undesired echoes in the chamber, and I was putting out brief pulses and listening for the echoes. Now, in order for us to proceed, you're very close to an extremely good working arrangement here. There's a couple of tricks that I learned in that process. First of all, the pulses that you're transmitting, you just said you're sending out a pulse. How long is the pulse you're transmitting? What is the repetition rate of the pulses you're transmitting? That's question number one. Over to you, John.
I'm manually stimulating it with a key. I pulse when I want to. I can do it quickly, of course, with the key, or slowly. The pulses, I would say, are probably around maybe, 50 microseconds.
You've got to get yourself a pulse generator, John. You cannot do this manually. You want pulses as brief as you can get. You want pulses as high a rep rate as you can get so that you get a nice bright display on the screen of repetitive events. But by properly synchronizing the oscilloscope, all of those pulses will lay on top of each other. And when you do it correctly, antenna, you'll pose up toward you, away from you, left or right, and so on. You've got to use a pulse generator. I bet you own a Hewlett-Packard pulse generator. I'm trying to remember the model number of the darn things. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, well, all my generators are capable of pulse or CW. I can do whatever I want with them, whether it's the Rodin Schwarzschild EHV. I got to say, you know, they all do that. But I tried that, and I got what appeared to be noise. I thought by using single pulses, I could get better resolution and try to find out where these things were coming from. But I didn't try. What pulse width would you suggest?
Do you own a Hewlett-Packard 812, Hewlett-Packard HB812, I think it's 812 was the model number, pulse generator? Go ahead.
No, it's a much newer one, up to 8 gig, but I can set the pulse rate or whatever I need.
I'm talking about a video pulse generator. You're talking about an RF transmitter that has pulse capability internal. I'm talking about a video pulse generator. You own a separate video pulse generator. John, go ahead.
Yes, I do. I have a couple of them, some Wavetech and one HP, but I didn't try using them for this item.
Do you own the HP Hewlett-Packard 812? Go in the other room and read me the model number on your Hewlett-Packard video pulse generator. Go ahead.
I know I don't own an 812. I don't have a 12... anything in HP. The Wavetech, I'm not sure of the model number.
How long will it take you to get me the model number of the HP? Go ahead.
Let me see if I have it available.
Now we're waiting for John to come back from his other laboratory. He's got two laboratories side by side in the building that he's in right now. He's going from one lab to the other. Look for the particular model number of that signal generator, the pulse, video pulse generator. And if John can hear me, what I'm saying is that when you're using a video pulse generator, you've got complete step rate, change the pulse duration, you can change the pulse rise time, the pulse and fall time. You've got all of these knobs on a video pulse generator that when you then use that video pulse generator going into the external pulse modulating port of an RF signal generator, you've now got all kinds of adaptability of the pulses that you're generating. There are RF signal generators that have pulse capability built in, but it's a very minor amount of pulse capability turned in, tuned in. Usually you can amplitude modulate internally, you can square wave modulate at a 1 kc rate, and that's about it. They got very little. Most RF signal generators have very little capability of the way you can adjust those pulses. So with an external video pulse generator commanding your RF signal generator, it gives you all kinds of capability that you need in this application. You're soon going to see why. I've been there. I've done this. KC2WGV, if you'd come back. K2RIW of the TechNet. I think I'm hearing KC2JXM. Very noisy. KC2JXM, start off with your name and make sure I've got your call letters correct. KC2JXM, K2RIW.
2JXM, copy.
I copy. Give me your call letters phonetically. What's your name, sir?
This is William. And call letters are Kilo Charlie 2, Juliet X-ray November.
Okay, I got the Juliet X-ray November. And you may have told me your name, but I missed it. Go ahead.
This is William. And this is Kilo 2, Juliet X-ray November.
Okay, William. I'm only copying you 50% of the time because your signal is so weak. Is there anything you can do to give us a little bit more signal? Go ahead.
We're standing on the Coney Island Sears, Coney Island Bay, using a VX7R. Trying to make it elevated.
Okay, you're standing on the Coney Island Pier, and you're elevating the handy talkie, if I understand correctly, and we're hearing you 50% of the time. We're hearing two words on, one word off, if you know what I mean. Go ahead.
I guess the little thing is I'm sort of way out of the pier, maybe I might hear the repeater well.
I think you said you're way out on the pier, and you're not hitting the repeater very well. That's an understatement. I'm just barely copying you, William. Go ahead.
One question about a vertical.
I heard the word vertical antenna, and I heard the word 20 meters. That's all I got out of that, William. Go ahead.
Antenna, 20 meters, antenna, is that a roger?
I heard 20 meters and roger. That's all I heard. Go ahead.
Mobile, I'm in my mobile. 26 mounted to the roof, 20 vertical of the trunk.
Okay, 20 meter antenna vertical mounted to the trunk. You gotta speak softer. You're over modulating and you're jumping out of the repeater. Go ahead.
Hey, roger there. Maybe I gotta hold the microphone a little further away. But I'm trying to use this in my little sport car, Fiat Spider. And I keep reading, no matter how I raise and lower the antenna, I keep getting an SWR reading of 1:1, which doesn't make any sense when I use the altitude and raise and lower the top portion of the vertical. And I don't know, I think my ground is okay. I connected the ground to the chassis. Over.
Okay, you're raising and lowering the antenna. It stays 1:1 standing wave ratio. Okay, when you said you're raising and lowering it, are you raising and lowering it a couple of inches out of 20 meters? Or are you raising and lowering it on a great big distance? How much raising and lowering are you doing? And what are you using to measure the standing wave ratio? It does sound strange. Back to you, William.
SWR and MFJ, I think it is the SWR meter, and I'm using that
helping out, so I can tell you're asking me a question about ground. I'm not making any sense out of it. Go ahead.
The ground. So I grounded the antenna mount to the of the car. Ran my speaker wire to the undercarriage of the car. Is that a sufficient ground?
Okay, you got to speak softer. You're overmodulating and dropping out. Got to remember to speak softer, because you overmodulate and you drop out, and I only hear every other word. Filming the metal of the car that you're grounding the antenna to is really connected to the rest of the frame of the car. It's not a floating piece of sheet metal that's held off with rubber buggy bumpers to make sure there's no rattling sounds. You've now got to do some investigating to find out the thing that you call ground. How much of the metal of the car is it really attached to? Over to you, William, KQLIW.
AC2JX, well, it's pretty much went under there and tied it to the undercarriage of the car, so it is the main chassis. And I scraped away some paint under there with some rust and sort of wrapped it around, pretty tight around the screw there. So I'm hoping that's sufficient ground, because I know these antennas have to be grounded very well.
Now, you say you're using your MFJ to measure standing wave ratio. You're measuring 1:1 all the time. The average person would be jumping up and down with joy if you can do that. You're measuring 1:1 and you're unhappy. I don't understand why you're unhappy. Over to you, Jim William, KQLIW.
Just wondering of that. It's at 20 meters, MFJ.6. So I was just wondering, if it's just cut for all parts of 20 meters, I have it, I tune it to at 14.245, and it's just like perfect, so I don't know if I'm getting a false reading, or what that really is. It's just, you know, it's one of these false positives, or false negative, or whatever you want to call it, but I'm hoping that's just a plain one-on-one, that it is a real true one-to-one ratio.
Almost every antenna of the kind you're talking about, when you sweep it from 14.0, 14.1, 14.2, 14.3, 14.4, and you plot that standing wave ratio curve, it usually is a U-shaped curve. The next thing for you to do to find out, are the readings you're measuring, are they reasonable, are they telling the truth? See if you can see a bathtub-shaped curve when you measure the Biswar at those other frequencies that you can tune to. Over to you, William. Please make sure you do not overmodulate. K2LIW.
KC2JXN. Well, I, basically, I switched it just to some other bands, and then if I switch to 10 meters, 20 meters thick, and the SWR does go way up. So I'm assuming that this 20 meters thick is just cut very well and resonates on all of 20 meters very well.
For a stick to resonate and give you 1.1 continuously all the way across 114.0 to 14.4, I won't say it's impossible, but it's very unusual. I'm now very skeptical about whether or not your standing wave ratio meter is telling the truth. And you can measure the truthfulness of your standing wave ratio meter. Can intentionally create a 2:1 standing wave ratio. In other words, take a piece of cable from your transmitter running at low power, go into a T connector, and put a 50 ohm load on both output ports of the T connector. You're putting a pair of 50 ohm loads in parallel, which by definition is 25 ohms, which is a 2:1 standing wave ratio. And if you do that, does your meter read 2:1 standing wave ratio? If not, find out why not. Over to you, William, KQLIW. Don't overmodulate.
Okay, I'll try doing that. I'll try setting something like that up, because it just seems that I would have been more comfortable if there was a fluctuation and I was able to reach a point where, you know, where it went up and down. That would seem more reasonable to me. It just seems unreasonable that it's just 1.0, 1.1, not even more than that. As I use the Allen key wrench and raise the top portion up, down, it doesn't seem to change much. So something does not seem right there.
When you use the Allen key to raise it up, down, how far are you moving it? How many inches? Over to you.
I'll move it. inches to, it looks like a two-man operation. I'll have my friend raise it up, maybe out as much as up of a foot to, that it doesn't fluctuate much.
That doesn't sound right. That sounds too good. It's time for you to do a Vizwar test like I mentioned. There's many ways of testing the Vizwar meter. I think your Vizwar meter may be giving you an optimistic result. Let us know what you find out when you investigate that, William. Let's see if John has come back. KC2WGB, what's the model number of your video pulse attenuator, pulse generator? Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Come in.
Person making the comment, give us your call letters and then your comment and your name.
Okay, very good, Dick. The name here is John. The call letters are AB2JA, Alpha Bravo 2 Juliet Alpha, located in Smithtown. I was just listening to the gentleman with the antenna question. I've worked with those little whips, and if the stinger portion or the metal rod portion that goes up and down, if that finds its way down into the coiled portion of the hamstick, and if he's raising it and lowering it within that coiled portion, I think that that might be the cause of the issue. The stinger portion has to be up above the coiled section, as far as I recall. Just a comment. I don't know if that's the answer, but I thought I'd throw it in there for whatever it's worth. K2RIW from AB2JA.
Yeah, good information, John, but as you can tell, William's complaint is that he's measuring too low a standing wave ratio all the time. You're telling us about a thing that can create high standing wave ratio if you don't do it right. I'm becoming skeptical of whether or not his standing wave ratio meter is telling the truth. The results sound too good. But he's going to do investigating of that a little bit further. KC2WGB, what's the model numbers of the video pulse generators you own, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. The ones that I have in the lab right now are Tektronix. They're the 115s. But describe what I need, what frequency, and what pulse duration, and I'll get the generator. I know I have a stack of HPs. I know I have an 814 in the lab, but that's an older one, but it has a very hefty pulse output.
Yeah, the 814, if it's the one I think it is an extremely good machine. You want the briefest possible pulse you can generate. The way I was doing it, John, my requirement was a little bit more severe than yours. I wanted to transmit a pulse that was less than 1 nanosecond long. And your particular requirement, 5 nanoseconds would probably be almost ideal if your pulse generator goes that brief. And the next thing you've got to worry about is you're going to the external pulse input port of your RF signal generator. And now you want to know what's the minimum pulse that it can generate, RF pulse. And also you worry about what is the on-off ratio. If your pulse generator has an on-off ratio of 10 dB, it's going to give you quite a bit of grief. 1 nanosecond per foot is the speed of light. So that if your target is, let me pick a number, 100 feet downrange, and you're transmitting a pulse to the target and you want to see the echo from the target, 100 nanoseconds one way, 100 nanoseconds back, 200 nanoseconds back, all around trip. So in that particular case, you can transmit pulses probably of 50 nanoseconds and easily resolve the pulses coming back from all the other clutter of the environment. And you're trying to minimize the coupling between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. And by the way, what is the receiving antenna going into? What is the pulse receiver in this particular case? And once again, how many feet downrange is your target, and what is the target? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
The target is a house. It's about 150 away from the receiving antenna. The receiving antenna comes in, goes to a 20 dB amplifier, and then goes to my spectrum analyzer and the oscilloscope. And then there's something else going into a chart recorder. But right now I'm basically interested in the oscilloscope response time and looking at the reflected pulse coming back after the trigger.
Okay, you intend to set the signal generator for how much power output, John? Go ahead.
Right now I'm just below 0 dBm, which is a sufficient pulse. I can clock that coming back. I can see it. It's a little muddy, but it also gives me just enough coupling to trigger the oscilloscope.
By way of you using an external video pulse generator, the main output from that video pulse generator is going to be commanding the pulse input port of your RF signal generator. The trigger pulse output of your video pulse generator is going to be triggering your oscilloscope. The last thing in the world you want to do is to trigger your oscilloscope by way of the RF response. That's going to give you all kinds of ambiguity. You want to command that directly from the video pulse generator. Now you've got complete control of the sweeping of the signal of the oscilloscope versus the echo you're getting. The next thing to worry about is how many decibels of gain is in that amplifier, because at 500 megacycles, the path of 150 yards, 450 feet, the path out to the house and back probably has 100 decibels of loss, starting off at 0 dBm out of the pulse generator. That means, not counting the gain of the antennas, what you're going to get back as an echo is going to be a hell of a lot weaker than minus 100 dBm. The numbers are not working out right here, John. You need more power output out of that signal generator. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, well, if I do that, I'm going to have to relocate the transmitting antenna. Otherwise, it'll swamp the receiving antenna. And triggering the scope with the generator is definitely possible. That's easy. But I decided to trigger on the receive signal instead. But I could do that. All right. So I'll change that around. You want me to use a video pulse generator to trigger the RF output. Again, coming in on the receive antenna, I have an amplifier, an HP. It's a 20 dB amplifier at that frequency. I think I'm going to need more gain than that.
And the receiver gain, from what you just described to me, you are only 80 decibels shy. And I'm not kidding. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I am getting a pulse back at the right timing. It's weak, but I have a lot of gain on the oscilloscope and on the spectrum analyzer. So, all right, so I got to get some more power. I do have a 3-watt capability that I could put the generator into. That's if I put 30 dBm in and I only have 18 dBm to operate that power amp. All right, I'll have to work on that.
Yeah, 3 watts is 33 dB stronger on transmit power compared to the 0 dBm you're running. Your oscilloscope is looking at the echo. I'm having trouble believing the oscilloscope is looking at 500 megahertz directly. You must be rectifying it with a crystal rectifier before putting it into that scope. How is that scope connected to that receiving antenna, John? Go ahead.
It's connected directly to the amplifier, the 20 dB amplifier. That it's my, it's 1 gigahertz, that scope, 4-channel 1 gigahertz, so it has no problem.
What's the best sensitivity of that oscilloscope? It goes down to how many millivolts or microvolts per centimeter? Go ahead.
Oh, the gain is fantastic, but I don't remember. Oh, God. I don't remember the lowest setting that I'm working at. In fact, I'm not even on the lowest. I'm one notch up from that.
Now, built into my handheld calculator, I just happen to have a program that's going to be very handy to you. I'm going to apply it right now. Your frequency is 500 megacycles. Your distance is 150 yards. Stand by while I calculate your path loss one way. Okay, 500 megacycles and 150 yards, 450 feet. Let me double check that I did it that way. Stand by while I do it. Look back at my numbers. Yes, I put in 500 megacycles and 450 feet. One-way path loss is 69 dB. So if you were going into a great big flat metallic wall as the target, have 69 dB of loss going out, 69 dB of loss coming back. You'd have a round trip loss of wrong.
138.
You've got it. 138 dB. You do have some antenna gain that helps, and you might have some target. Let me think about this now. No, you've got some target gain. That would be the loss if I simply doubled the distance. It'd be 6 dB more. Your echo is going to come back, rough number, 80 dB weaker. So whatever power transmitting you're making, your echo coming back is going to be 80 dB weaker. Once you know the millivolts or microvolts of sensitivity of your 500 megacycle oscilloscope and the amount of transmit power you've got out of the transmitter and the gain of the antennas, you can make the numbers come out right. 0 dBm, I don't think you stood a chance. Does that oscilloscope have so much gain that you see noise on the screen, John? Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, absolutely. And I can see, I can stack the front-end amplifiers on two of them, so I can double up that way, but the noise gets to be outrageous. But I'm seeing the return pulse, but it is so muddy with the reflections that it was driving me crazy. And when I noticed when I went to vertical polarity, signal coming back was about the same, but yet the side lobes and the bouncing signals that were interfering were reduced about 20 dB.
But once you start setting this up correctly with a repetitive video pulse generator with external triggering of your oscilloscope, oh, you're going to be 100 dB better in pleasure of the screen you've got. In other words, the screen will sit still and you'll know what you're looking at. You want to make a, what do you believe is the briefest pulses comes out of your video pulse generator? What do you believe is the minimum pulse duration that your RF signal generator will produce? And what do you believe is the on-off ratio of your RF signal generator? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, I know I can get down into the nanos on the pulse timing. That's definite. Right now, I think I have a generator. Well, it doesn't matter what the generator pulse amplitude is because I'm going to be using that as a trigger for my RF unit. So even if it can produce 100 volts, it's not going to help me. All right, that's what was the other question you asked me?
Your RF signal generator, you're externally pulsing it. What do you believe is its on-off ratio of those pulses?
It's less than 10 dB, that I'm sure of, but I don't have that sheet in front of me. I'm not sure if I remember correctly. I think it's about 1.
Okay, you're answering some other question, John. I'm asking you the decibels of on-off ratio of the RF signal coming out of your RF pulse generator. When the pulse is on, it's giving you 0 dBm. When the pulse is off, how many minus dBm is coming out of that signal generator? Over to you, John.
That I'm not sure of. That I don't have a clue.
By way of your oscilloscope, you can measure that. Over to you, John.
Yeah, but I don't remember looking for that or even trying to look at it. I was just looking at the peaks I was sending out to make sure I had enough to trip the trigger and then looking for that response.
Now let's assume now that the isolation between your transmitting antenna and your receiving antenna, even though you've favorably mounted them in position and separation and whatever, let's assume you've got 25 decibels of isolation between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. And now let's assume that the on-off ratio of your RF signal generator is 25 dB. Under those conditions, just the leakage signal coming out of your RF signal generator during the time you're trying to receive the echo from the building 150 yards away, that leakage signal in the environment I just described can easily be 40 dB stronger than the echo you're looking for. That doesn't mean you're not going to see the echo. It just means that the echo you're looking for is now 40 dB weaker than the leakage signal, and you're looking for a bug under the rug, and that's going to be kind of difficult. You've got the right equipment. but there's a zillion different ways you can hook it up. And the way you've hooked it up so far, John, I've gone down this road once before. I've gone through this learning curve. It's amazing how repetitive this is. You're repeating an interesting piece of history. Over to you, John. KQRIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, what I did notice is the leakage can be read on the spectrum analyzer, and it's coming in quite a bit lower than the pulse that's being transmitted, of course, and it's a little lower than the pulse that's coming back. So I don't think that's an interference problem. And it's coming in the frequency domain. I can see it right there below the transmitted pulse and the received pulse.
In this environment, I think you've got to use your spectrum analyzer in the time domain, not the frequency domain. In other words, you want the spectrum analyzer sitting on your 500 megacycle frequency steady, not doing any sweeping. And now it's displaying in the time domain the amplitude of the pulses it sees. And by way of the external triggering port of your video pulse generator, you can also be properly triggering the spectrum analyzer in the time domain mode. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, that's why I have the oscilloscope in the time domain mode, although I could do the fast Fourier and have a display of the frequency, but I'm using my spectrum analyzer for the frequency domain, and I'm sweeping a very narrow portion. I could lock it on 500 meg just to keep that there, like you're suggesting. I didn't try that, but that may be some way to look at it. Okay, I'm going to have to set that experiment up a little differently and try it the way you're suggesting. Now, do you think I should keep them vertically polarized because of the abhorrent structures adjacent to it, or do you think I should go back to the horizontal polarity?
There are so many other factors here going on, John, where the numbers don't come out right. When I calculated the echo power you should be getting, and I'm reasonably sure that it's way below the threshold of the instrumentation you're using, as well as it being below the leakage power, there's so many ambiguities in what you've done up till now that you thought you saw something on that screen. I'm not sure that what you saw was real. I think you saw some other effects. Until you get a clearly defined pulse duration with a clearly defined rep rate out of a nice steady state video pulse generator, where all your receiving equipment is now externally triggered by the pulse generator. Until you set that all up, I've also tried to use RF triggering, and it's filled with 40 problems. You don't want to use RF triggering on a radar system. You want to use external commanded video triggering of your receiving equipment. There's too many ways it can give you ambiguities. Yes, you saw things on the screen and you made a certain interpretation. I think you're ultimately going to find out that what you thought you saw and the reality are very different. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, very good, Dick. Now, I'll reset that experiment up and try it. By the way, what pulse rep do you recommend? What do you think I should try within a spectrum?
Your pulses are going to be, let me think now, 450 feet out, 450 feet back, 900 feet round trip. Well, that's 900 nanoseconds. That's almost a microsecond. You could set the rep rate as fast as 10 microseconds of period, even as low as 1 microsecond. But 10 microsecond period, that would be what? Stand by. That's 100 kc. You could make the rep rate 100 kc. The advantage of doing that is you'd be laying a whole lot of pulses on top of each other, and you'd get a nice, bright display on that screen on a sunny day. The nice thing about a 500 megacycle scope is it can look at fast pulses, but when it's looking at very fast pulses, you get an extremely dim screen unless you've got a very, very high rep rate. You can use a rep rate as high as 100 kc in this case, John, K2RIW.
Well, the LaCroix goes up to 1 gigahertz, Dick, and no problem with trace. No problem at all. It's an excellent scope. All right, so I'll try that. I wrote those numbers down, and I'm going to try to set that up this coming week, and maybe I'll have more information for the next TechNet. But it's a little tough working in the driveway with all the obstructions. It's a pain in the butt in a way. And I don't know, I haven't even got it, the ground reflections, which may be another part of what's being displayed.
Yeah, every realistic radar has in the near field what's called ground clutter display. And therefore they quite often use something called STC, signal time constant. In other words, they put in a variable gain during each individual pulse of reception in order to attenuate close-in ground clutter. When you get this set up correctly, the fact that there's an automobile in the car, in the driveway, is not going to bother you at all. That's just going to be a great big pulse in close. And you'll be able to easily resolve that from the weaker pulse, 900 nanoseconds downrange. The real echo you care about is echo from that host, 900 feet round trip distance. Therefore, it's going to come back 900 nanoseconds later. To resolve that compared to a close in pulse from a close in echo, that's easy. As long as the pulse duration is short enough. Now, if your pulse duration is long enough, is too long so that it overlaps everything, of course, resolving individual items is going to be difficult. You've got the raw material. It's just a matter of setting it up correctly, John. And it's going to take a number of experiments before you get there. I presume you're using the house 150 yards away just as a friendly target to prove the concept. You're not trying to really find out how anechoic that house is. Is that true, John? Over to you, KGRIW.
That's it, Dick. I'm using it for a sounding board. I was going to park my van in front of the house so I would have a nice metal target to look at, but it's got a nice metal door in the front, very large door, and a lot of metal in the area, so I know I'll get signal from that house. But interesting. And my next question is, your experience with radar. When you're looking at things like ground clutter or trying to tell the difference between some structure that's important to look at, do they use a specific frequency or vary the frequency when they're looking at different ground targets?
The answer is almost always no. Unless your particular target happens to have a particular resonant frequency, unless it has a resonant frequency, as you sweep the RF frequency and you're looking at the echo of a target, very little happens. So your particular target, as you described it to me, is not very frequency sensitive. And when you get the setup correctly, I'm not even convinced you're going to find very much polarization sensitivity. I think the polarization sensitivity you've seen is a straw man. Something else funny is going on. But you didn't stand a chance to manually pulse this thing, John. You had to be very fast, repetitively pulsing. You want 100,000 video pulses per second, where each video pulse is some number of nanoseconds. And you want those to be flying out of there, 100,000 of them per second, in order to get a nice, bright display where everything is real time, and now you can really adjust the knobs and see something reasonable. Manually pulsing, I've never seen anybody try to do that in the past, John. You're the first. You're a brave guy. Hold your John, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of nothing, but it's a lot of fun. All right, if we have it, I'll go over to the mailbag. I got two questions, nice simple ones. Let me let it drop. DC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Funny thing, you were just mentioning before, and this young gentleman wants to know if he picked a volume of water. He's happened to mention a cubic foot. He wants to know if water has a resonant frequency. What is it, and what kind of testing could he do for that?
Now, water does have a resonant frequency when it's in the vapor form. So if you sprayed a very small amount of mist of water, or just normal water humidity in the air, does have a resonant frequency. That resonant frequency, I'm going to call it resonance, it's really an absorption frequency. It's very close to 22 gigahertz. The very first absorption line of water vapor is 22 gigahertz. If you've got a vat of water, first of all, if I had a metallic container like, for instance, the container inside of my microwave oven. It's got a certain volume. There's a certain distance between the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall, the forward wall and the back wall, the top wall and the bottom wall. It is a six-sided cavity. As a cavity, it has a resonant frequency. I don't know the exact number, but maybe that resonant frequency is somewhere around 3 gigahertz. You now put water inside that cavity. Water has a dielectric constant of 81. 1 over the square root of 81 is around 9. So the frequency of resonance of the cavity is going to move down by 9 to 1 because I put water in there and I've dielectrically loaded the cavity. You think you're measuring the resonance of the water. Not at all. You're measuring the resonance of the container, the metallic container that the water is in, and the water is simply your capacitive loading of that container. Water has no real resonant frequency until you get up to roughly 22 gigahertz. AC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, and we find that out when we get into satellite reception and the raindrops. 20. All right, well, that was his question, but I don't think he has anything that he can get up in that frequency to make any tests with. He has some very, very simple equipment. All right, well, that answers that for him. Let me let it drop. I'm on to my next one.
From the nature of that question, John, you think he wanted to measure the resonant frequency of water in order to what? Find out what happens as you add salt to it, as you heat it up and cool it off. What did he really want to do? He wanted to use water as a resonator of some kind. Go ahead.
Well, his question was rather vague, but what I believe he's trying to do is think about water such as distilled water, salt water, fresh water, and how that resonance would change with the additives of different elements in the solution. And I think that's where he was working in that area. But I don't think he would be able to experiment with the equipment he has with anything empirical.
Yeah, almost any kind of metallic container he used to hold the water, he'd really be measuring the resonant frequency of the container, the cavity resonant frequency of the container, and the water would simply be a dielectric loading material inside of the container, acting as extra capacitance, lowering that resonant frequency to a lower frequency. And once you do that, you could put the water into a container, calculate ahead of time, knowing water has a dielectric constant of 81, and knowing the dimensions of your container. Maybe you make the container as a thin, long trough, so to speak, so that the length is the major resonant frequency across the two ends that are furthest apart, and you could calculate that frequency, and then add salt and alcohol and other things to the water, changing the dielectric constant of the water in a somewhat predictable manner, and measure the change of the resonant frequency of the cavity as the water changes the stuff that's dissolved into it. That's a possible experiment. You think you're measuring the resonant frequency of the water? No, you're really measuring the resonant frequency of the cavity with water in it as a loading dielectric material. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, very good. Now that brings up another question which might help him. Now, if we built a container and it held, 700 milliliters of water, now we just take the container and change the shape, but it still holds 700 milliliters. Would that resonate differently?
Ordinarily, that cavity of your microwave oven, for instance, if you had some kind of a vector network analyzer with a probe going into it, another probe coming back out, you've got two probes into your microwave oven cavity. You could do that by taking skinny little pieces of coax cable and sneaking it in beyond the door, if you know what I mean. So you've got two probes in there, and as you sweep the frequency with your vector network analyzer, you're going to find all about six resonant frequencies. One of the resonant frequencies is really a function of the spacing between the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall. Another resonant frequency will be the spacing between the ceiling and the floor. Another resonant frequency will be from the front wall to the back wall. Another resonant frequency will be a compound bounce between those three walls, and you'll get a zillion of those resonant frequencies. You'll get a very complicated curve. Let me drop. If, by comparison, I took a piece of copper pipe, a round piece of copper pipe, and I made it, let me pick a number, 2 feet long, 3 feet long, and I put a short circuit on the two ends, and I put two probes into that copper pipe, maybe one near the far end and one near the near end, and now I measured the resonant frequency in that copper pipe as a microwave waveguide, a round piece of waveguide. The major resonant frequency will be the length of the distance between the forward shorted wall and the rearward shorted wall of this copper pipe. There would be another resonant frequency between the top and bottom of this round copper pipe. But because that distance is, in my example, 30 times shorter, that resonant frequency will be 30 times higher, and it won't confuse you. I've now set up a one-dimensional resonator, a piece of copper pipe, a known distance, with a short circuit on the two ends and two probes in there. Now I've got one simple resonant frequency, and I pour water into that copper pipe. The amount of change in that resonant frequency will be roughly a 9-to-1 ratio, because the water's got a dielectric constant of 81 at most of the frequencies of interest. Now by changing the materials inside of that water, salt, calcium chloride, sodium chloride, alcohol, and whatever, you'll get different resonant frequencies because the water with those different materials in it has a different dielectric constant. And heating it up and cooling it off will change its velocity of propagation a little bit. So there's a whole bunch of measurements you can make in that environment because you've now created a one-dimensional resonator per se. It's got one main resonant frequency, length. You've taken this very complicated problem and drastically simplified it by using that piece of copper pipe. KC2
repeater, timeout.
KC2 WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2 WGB, just figured I'd let it drop so we don't lose anything here. Very good. Now, there's an experiment maybe he can do. That would not take much. So, very good. All right. I'm going to drop out and go on to the next one. Okay. Have a young amateur here who has a VON, and he has a resistor in it that is burnt. He cannot tell the value. How would he go about replacing that? What is your recommendation, Dick? How should he proceed? And I also have some information on what might be possibly useful, too.
First of all, by way of tracing out the wiring diagram, finding the schematic if possible, or looking at the two ends of the resistor, and by studying the way the rotary dial works, the rotary switch, you know when you're making contact to that resistor. You've got to find out, was that resistor being used for a voltage measurement, a current measurement, or an ohmmeter measurement? Okay, to burn out a resistor in the voltage measurement mode, I won't say it's impossible, but it's very unlikely. To burn out a resistor in the ohmmeter mode, in other words, you've got it set on one of the very low ohmmeter scales, one ohm, a times one scale, or the times 10, or the times 100 scale. The low ohm scales do have a very small resistor that's in series with the probe, and if now you made the mistake of putting voltage across the two probes when the meter is in the ohmmeter range, now you can burn up that resistor. Once you confirm that it's the resistor used in the times 10 scale, the times 1 scale, there's ways you can calculate what that resistor has got to be. So, now, let me drop this. There's a slim possibility the guy had it in the current measuring mode, which really you have to take the red lead and plug it into a different place. And in the current